extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. It is Monday, June 17th, a wild MLS weekend to break down match day 20. All the nooks and crannies coming your way with plenty of transfer news and rumblings to include among those discussions. Doyle, what's up, man? It's going to be a big show.
It feels like I haven't seen you for a month. We've been like ships crossing in the night, not managing to align our schedule. So it's good. I'm looking forward to catching up a little bit and talking about this. This week we had, so every week in my column, I do pass of the week, and it's not best pass of the week, right? Sometimes it's just a pass that I want to use to sort of illustrate a concept, whatever, but when I'm lazy, it's best pass of the week. And this week I was lazy and I was like, oh, that's fine. I'll just, you know, pick something from the NYCFC Columbus game because there were so many great moments in that one. But then I looked, there were like six different passes from like Miki Yamane on the Galaxy's second goal. There was a sick through ball from, I think, Dylan Barrero on the run for a jacket. There was a lot of great soccer this weekend, and I was pretty hyped for it.
Oh, absolutely. Lucho Acosta just was like, you know what? I think it's time. Yeah. I'm going to go Super Saiyan on this game. We need 3 points. I mean, just across the board, it was a great weekend, a great match day 20. And it was one of those weekends when you look at the slate and the schedule ahead of it, you're sort of like, man, like, it doesn't really have one game that just jumps off the page other than Friday night in the Bronx. I thought it was going to be a stinker, and those sometimes happen mid-year. They often happen around international breaks where you have those absences, and then the game's delivered, and you know they're going to deliver on Wednesday because midweek MLS is always the most bonkers MLS, and it's all free Wednesday on MLS Season Pass, Apple TV. Pay no money. Just get an account, get on there. You can watch it all, including the pregame show at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, MLS Countdown. I believe Robin Fraser is going to join us for that show, so it should be interesting to pick his brain about the league at large. And then, of course, MLS 360, you can watch your game whenever it is happening over the course of the night. And at the end of the night, 12:30, you got MLS Wrap-Up, and you can watch that one on demand if you don't like to stay up in the middle of the night, in the middle of the week. I completely get that. I am tired, too. Very tired. And then we do it all again Saturday. So, no, I agree, man. It's great to be back. It's great to chat with you. You weren't in the studio this weekend, and normally that's sort of our, you know, our like 6 to 8 hours of just sitting there mainlining the league. So, let's try to replicate that a little bit now, but let's also remind people that if they need more MLS talk, if they need more deep dives, our very good friends, our partners in soccer, David Goss, Tom Boger, and Jordan Angeli have started a new project. SoccerWise HQ is here. It is freaking awesome. I'm locked in. I'm subscribed on YouTube. I'm subscribed wherever you listen to podcasts. It is both a joy for me to hear them talk about the game, the North American game in particular, MLS, NWSL, anything going on our continent, but also it makes me a little bit sad that I don't get to do it twice a week anymore. Alas, it's okay. They're going to have 3 shows a week. You can follow them on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Twitch, and of course, anywhere you get your pods. So very excited for that that project. And the more coverage in American soccer, Canadian soccer, North American soccer, the better.
Are they officially now our rivals in soccer? Are David and Tom, ooh, and I guess Jordan, no longer our partners in soccer? By the way, Jordan, we've had on this show a number of times over the years. She's going to carry the load with those two guys. I mean, it's going to be all on her shoulders.
Yeah. She's pretty sharp. In that shed, certainly, she's the first tool you're pulling out between the three of those folks. Rivals, huh? I hadn't thought about it that way. I'm not against it, specifically in an Anchorman sort of idea. You know, the scene where they're all coming together and Dorothy Mantooth, et cetera, and then they have the big brawl. I feel like we're going to lose that brawl.
Yeah, I don't like our chances against Tom and Dave.
No, there's a certain lot of rage. You know, knife in the teeth, I will do anything to win, scratch and claw mentality from that group. So let's just keep it partners. Let's keep this thing friendly.
Smart. All right, Glad we worked through that.
Yeah. Ooh, okay. All right. We're safe. Best thing you saw from match day 20, Doyle. Get us started.
Yeah, I already mentioned it, man. That crew NYCFC game on Friday night was awesome. I just love Friday night MLS. I love, you know, Viernes de Football, as it was called for a while back, like a decade ago. I think it's just the best way to kick off a match day, getting at, like, in perfect world, there would be a couple of standalone games so that we could feature some of these teams. Because if you're watching your team or you're watching 360 on Saturday night, you're probably not going to catch a full version of the Crew or NYCFC or Cincinnati or Miami or whatever, the best teams in the league. So getting that standalone on Friday night brought me back a little bit. And I loved it because I was able to focus completely on that game, and it was a banger. It was an absolute banger. Matt Freeze was incredible in goal for NYCFC, keeping them. He gave up three goals, but I think he still saved like two goals above expected in that one. The midfield play for both teams, getting to see, you know, Santiago Rodriguez really coming to his own, and one of the best number 10s in the league. The Crew doing Crew things. NYCFC playing down a man for about 50 minutes in this one and still hanging in. It was awesome. It was two teams that have a ton of talent and want to use the ball in different ways, right? Because NYCFC aren't the same positional play team that they were a couple of years ago, but it's fine because they figured out a way to be sort of relentless and dynamic within that. I think it produced one of the best games of the season. And we're obviously, all of us are all in on the Crew as being a great team in this league. I think NYCFC is just about there as well. And in part, that's because of Alonso Martinez, the Costa Rican winger, who they've now converted into like kind of a Tati Castellano style number nine. He runs everywhere. He's relentless pressing defensively. He figures out ways to be an outlet and not necessarily a back to goal center forward. It was all great. Like, literally every moment of my Friday night was great, especially because there was definitely no other TV, sporting events on that night. Definitely no NBA to watch.
Nothing,
that
certainly
night.
Nothing that would, you know, grab your attention and hold it. I mean, the Celtics nothing grabbed their attention and held it on that. That was a gift. That was a gift for the Mavericks. Don't worry about that. It's all good.
I would have been spiraling if not for Viernes de Football. That's the best thing I saw this weekend.
And that was even with a rain delay. I was trying to get tickets to this match, and my wife made plans that were not Friday soccer. Imagine that. She said, you know, as a family, we can't dedicate more time to Major League Soccer. But look, the Crew showed some really good resolve in this match to weather that rain delay, so to speak, and then come out and perform. New York City played very well, but shot themselves in the foot. The Ilinich red card was just, I mean, that was just a brain fart for me. Like, Ramirez is past you, man. It's the first half. Don't shove him. And Christian Ramirez is so smart and so slow, like, no offense, Christian knows it, that when he feels that contact, he's not thinking, oh, I'm just going to ride this and try to go. You know, he's like, no, this is a perfect opportunity. I am going down. That's a red card for Dogso. And now we have an advantage the rest of the game. I wasn't, you know, I think maybe my biggest takeaway from this game is one of those MLS, like, in the weeds nerd takes. And that is that Max Arfstein is one of my favorite players in this entire league. It is absolutely crazy the quality that this guy is bringing to the Columbus Crew and the fit that he has at wingback for a Crew team that basically says, okay, you're playing wingback, but the focus is on wing. You are a winger. We want you in the box. We want you providing width. We want you all the way up the field in the final third when we arrive. And often you're going to be the one who's arriving first and triggering everything. I mean, I believe there was a winger, wing back to wing back goal in this one to Mo Farsi. Mm-hmm. And Cucho was just on his, I mean, he was absurd. Some of the passes and moves that he was making this one. But Max Arfstein has mostly played right wing back. Yep. He's been a sub for Mo Farsi. He played left wing back in this one. And Wilfred Nancy told me this week that Max Arfstein might be the best technical player on the entire team, that he does not have a strong foot, so to speak. Both are equally absurd. This is a guy, Doyle, they took him in the super draft. When they took Max Arfstein in the super draft from MLS Next Pro, snatched him from the Quake second team, we didn't even know who he was. I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, we had to fake that one.
I didn't know.
I remember that. We immediately threw it to poor Devin Kerr, who was on the call for this game, by the way. We're like, Devin, tell us about this. And Devin was tap dancing because he was the first player who was drafted out of Next Pro. He wasn't technically drafted out of college, so we didn't have him in the college guidebook. And yeah, we had no idea. And if you had told me then that he would be this type of player now, I would have called you a liar, even though he had very good numbers in Next Pro. But you know, to your point about being two-footed, I'm just looking him up on Transfer Market, and they have him as left-footed. And I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know legit that
thought he was right-footed.
He was, what?
Yeah.
Well, so, the more you learn. The more you learn, and, the more you know.
This is the advantage of having Wilfred Nancy as your head coach, because he's gonna develop young players. He's gonna give them chances, and he's gonna give them opportunities to thrive, and the expectation and the confidence that they have to that they can thrive. He did it last year with guys like Patrick Schulte, Malte Amundsen, who was kind of spare parts for this NYCFC team, guys like Yaya Boah and Alexandre Matan, who were kind of on the outs in Columbus, and
Zawadzki
and
Marrera, finding the perfect sort of role for a Camacho. That's not development. It's just seeing talent and seeing where a player can best fit. And I completely agree with you on opportunity. I would also just add that structure,
yeah,
and clarity of expectations is so important in this as well, both for players to get into a team and understand what they're doing and grow, but also in the recruitment side of it. Like, yeah, there's a very clear profile that the Crew could go out and say, this is what we want from wingbacks. These are the attributes they have. And then go get a guy that maybe other people aren't thinking about in the same way, that just fits so perfectly. And Mo Farsi is another example of that exact sort of execution of game model, coach, and then recruitment department. Mo Farsi, I mean, they signed him to Crew 2 out of CPL, and it was like, oh, okay, this guy's got to play. Oh, so much so that when push comes to shove in the playoffs, Julian Gressel, who we traded a bunch for, who has a profile that is far above Mo Farsi's in this league, you're going to the bench in crunch time, Doug. It's going to be Mo Farsi. And in this match, Mo Farsi had one of his better games, I think, for the Crew, and there's still so much room for him to grow, which is incredible. But I felt really happy for him, because I don't know, other than Crew fans, who remembers last year at Yankee Stadium for Mo Farsi? He had an own goal late in the game to give up what was a 1-0 lead. And so for him to flip that around and come back and draw a penalty on Hannes Wolf and to score a goal and be the guy tapping it in at the back post, I mean, this was just an absolutely brilliant game, a great performance from the Crew. And I think if you're Nick Cushing, who we had the pleasure of talking with, was it last week? I believe it was last week. I don't think you take anything from this game other than we can stand toe-to-toe with the best.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because they were battered. They gave up 3 goals at home. They ultimately lost a home game, and that's never good. But I wrote in my column, and I firmly believe, like, I came away from this game even more impressed by NYCFC. And NYCFC have been really impressive over the past couple of months. But to play this well, win down a man, the red card, as you said, was a brain fart. It was stupid. It is not emblematic of how this team has conducted themselves. I don't think that NYCFC is in that top group of teams.
Agreed.
But they're not far. They're a half step down from that group of teams. They're really, really fun and really excellent. And with Maxi Morales back, they have the ability to go back to being the kind of sustain possession, pull you apart with midfield orchestration rather than pull you apart with sort of back to front transition. They have a different club in the bag, and get your stock now, man, because it's only going up at this point. And it's nice to see it, because look, man, 3 months ago, I thought that Nick Cushing was going to be out before we hit this point in the season. And he was, I think, hanging on by a thread, and he has gotten his guys to answer the bell, and they're playing some of the best ball in the league.
I got to tell you, go listen to that interview if you haven't already. I mean, look, you're listening to Extra Time, so you probably saw it and listened to it. And if you didn't, go check it out. It was in our previous show, a long chat with Nick Cushing about what's going on in New York, what's working, and where they're headed as a team, both in the transfer window and long term. Some other news that we should just hit in this game. First of all, Wednesday night, the Crew are going to Miami. They won 4 straight away games. It's another one, so that's a game to watch. But also, the Crew look like they're about to add another piece. Speaking of young guys that need an opportunity, need a little structure, Isaiah Jackson has fallen off big time this year for St. Louis. but ton of people reporting. Brianna McKay has been all over it in Columbus. She's a great follow and really covers the Crew from back to front. Says the Crew are close to finalizing a deal with St. Louis for Jackson in exchange for Gam. Manuel Veth is reporting that it's a done deal and that it's $650K in Gam. None of this is official yet. These are just sort of numbers we can use as we talk about it. What do you think? Jackson to the Crew?
I love it. Now, this is in conjunction with St. Louis are signing a German player from, I think, St. Pauli. Who
I think he's
is
out of contract. Marcel Hartl. He's been an absolute baller in the two Bundesliga. And we'll talk more about that in terms of what it means for St. Louis. But yes, these are sort of linked moves.
And this was a player that I think Columbus were interested in first. And I don't know if they eventually sort of backed off on their interest or weren't able to get it over the finish line. But yeah, these are two linked moves. So it's not like St. Louis are giving something up here only to have a bigger purse. It's like, no, this is actually to expedite something that is already happening, something that they frankly need to happen. But the Aziel Jackson thing, like, this kid was so good and so dynamic last year. As he said, he's sort of fallen off, and I think the structure of St. Louis changing a little bit has been a part of that. But you put him in Columbus in that two line in the 3-4-2-1. It wouldn't shock me if this kid ends up being sort of like a 7-goal, 14 assist type of player under Wilfried Nancy, because he has the ability to play accurate line breaking passes while on the run.
Yes.
And all of that together matters. And there are guys who can play accurate line breaking passes, but they can't do that while they're on the run. There are guys who can connect passes on the run, but they can't break lines while they do that. Aziel Jackson can put it all together. So I think if you put him in the structure that Wilfried Nancy has created, it wouldn't shock me if a year from now we're thinking $650,000 worth of GAM was not enough.
Yeah, to me, it's the way he... in transition moments, and I know we talk about Crew as this possession heavy team, but to me, when they're at their very best, it's when they have sucked you in with possession, and that's not how they break you down. They break you down in that transition moment. It's just it's a nightmare. Think of him like with Diego Rossi next to him, and Cucho creating space, being someone to play off of, being the finisher at time. That is terrifying if they can get him up to speed. And it sure seems like with the other rumors around the Crew, I don't know if Dylan Chambos maybe that won't happen because of this. I don't know. But it sure seems like in the summer, they're looking around saying, I think we can get even better here. And that's got to be scary for the rest of MLS. We'll talk about the Supporters Shield and that race in just a second. And the Crew, by the way, are absolutely in that race right now, even on 27 points, because they have so many games in hand. All right, best thing I saw. First of all, best thing I heard. This is sort of an aside. Robbie Rogers... on that Galaxy broadcast, there was a long interview with Robbie, and I mean, he's such an interesting person and has done so many things in his life. And, you know, we applaud him, of course, for his bravery and his personal courage in terms of coming out and becoming the first openly gay player in North American professional leagues. And, you know, we hope that legacy continues and grows and grows. But I love the pettiness from him. He is a Galaxy boy through and through. Quote, I hate LAFC. I really do. And the fans everywhere I am, I drop my kids off at school and everyone is wearing LAFC stuff. He's a real one. He's a real one. Just fueling that El Tráfico rivalry. I love that. So I was glad to hear Robbie on the broadcast and thought that was really cool. You can go watch a feature with Robbie that the Galaxy put together that's really good around Pride Month. The other best thing I saw here is going to be Peter Luxain, the vibe check. Interim manager for FC Dallas. He's been in the organization for 10, 11 years at this point, both as a player and then as a coach at all different levels. The change was made away from Nico Estevez. And when it happened and they went to Luxain and said, look, it's an audition for him for the rest of the year, my first thought, Doyle, was, okay, well, Dallas are going back to what they know and is what has made them the most successful. And that is people that truly understand the core of what the club is about and what the area is about. If you think back to the history of this club and what the Hunts have done and the coaches that they've hired and succeeded with, Shelis Hyndman is like, you know, a Dallas legend at SMU, a guy that they knew back to front, helped usher in sort of a new era and won some things with David Ferreira. But then it was Oscar Pareja, again, academy, the club, and then it was Lucci. And those are really the most successful years in terms of results as well as talent development from within the academy. And Luke Sane to me is a continuation and a return maybe to that sort of idea. And you could just feel the difference in attitude I felt both on the field, though the performance was kind of ugly. They did beat St. Louis, but it was not ideal. But definitely in terms of just the mannerisms and the aggression of the players in certain moments. And then afterwards, when Luke Sane is doing the interview and Nikosi Tafari, who's been in and out of the team this year, jumps on his back, puts the cowboy hat on his head, and they're smiling and they're laughing. It just felt like a little bit of a fresh start for Dallas and one that they needed. And it was encouraging and fun. And that's not to pile on Nico Estevez and say like, oh, well, you know, it was terrible under Nico and they hated it and he was a bad coach. That's not true. It just was sort of an indication to me of how much these players care about and believe in Luke Sane and the opportunity that he has in front of him and his investment in the club. So we'll see if it pays off.
Yeah,
Jesus Ferrer got a goal. That was nice. Tafari got a goal, but you know, the vibes were good.
The measure I think is going to be, I mean, obviously they're going to need Tafari to be the guy he was in 2022 and 2023. And they're going to need the same from Jesus Ferreira, but guys like Bernie Camungo, Dante Sealy, that we had really high hopes for entering the season, they've barely registered, and injuries have been part of that. But there's also just been a sort of a malaise over this team. And part of the way you break through that is by promoting young, aggressive players into bigger roles. And that seemed to have stalled out over the past, you know, year, maybe even year and a half. It hasn't come in the way it had in previous seasons. Now, underpinning all of this is Alan Velasco is still hurt, and he's their, you know, DP chance creator. And, you know, Paxton Pomykal is done for the year, and he was supposed to be a big part of how they were going to dominate midfield, and they don't really have a replacement for that. And the back line, especially with Tafari underperforming, the back line is sort of bereft of high-level MLS talent. So it all sort of added up and ended up being pretty grim under Nico Estevez. It was nice to see Luke Sane get a win to start his tenure, be it interim or long term. But the real story here is that Dallas don't have the talent to be at or even near the top of the Western Conference. And Luke Sane doing more to push young players into the 11 or even the 18. It's a Band-Aid, right? This group needs to go shopping as soon as the transfer window opens, and they need to keep shopping in the winter probably as well, because there's just, you watch them play and you watch, you know, LAFC or RSL, and the gap is significant.
I mean, look, there is a lot of talent on this team. I do agree with Dan Hunt when he said that he said it's the most talented. I don't agree with that. It's extremely talented up top, in particular with Musa and Ferreira. And, you know, I think Areola at a wingback position is going to get more out of him than they had before. And you have to include Velasco in the talent, even though he's not available. The issue for me was just quality and depth in midfield and at the back line. Like, if you're going to play with three center backs and then you're going to start benching Tafari, you don't have the quality to do it. And if you're banking on Paxton and Iatamendi to be basically like this constant duo, I'm sorry, that was never going to happen. Now, the goalkeeper position is good. Musa is a good player whose the style of play hasn't suited. Ferreira is obviously a good player who's been injured for a good amount of time. There are pieces now for Luke Sane to work with, but ahead of a stretch of four home games and five for Dallas, it seemed like the right time to make a change if they were going to make it and just try to inject some belief and get some momentum going to climb this table and find a way close to the playoff spot so the rest of the year has some intrigue. Let's flip it, though. Because St. Louis quietly, or maybe not so quietly if you're following their fans, are in a really bad run of form right now. One win in their last nine, it's not good. It's not good. And Doyle, if you listen to the last show, Bradley Carnell came on and tried to give things from his point of view, and I thought he did a good job of that. But, you know, they're tied for last in MLS in non-penalty XG per shot. They're not creating good goal-scoring opportunities. They had a ton of shots in this game, but I thought it was emblematic in the 94th minute when Roman Berkey, like, pulled up from forever away and was just like, I'm going to hit one. Like, I'm going to take a shot. Like, it didn't happen any other way for us, so why not me? And then there was a meeting on the field after the game with Lutz Fahdenstiel, Bradley Carnell, and his assistants. There is more talent coming in, but, man, there's something stalled about the project right now.
Yeah, I think they got kind of a false positive in the first two-thirds of last year when they rode that just incredible wave of finishing luck to they overperformed by 15 points, would you say? But what we saw starting with Leagues Cup last year and then in down the stretch and then into the playoffs was that they weren't really that team. And if you look at the underlying numbers, St. Louis have, I think, just about hit their expected goals output. Last year, they overperformed their expected goals output. I think they scored 63 goals on about 42 XG. So they overperformed by 50%. And I think that maybe made the front office a little bit complacent. And they didn't go out and reinforce the squad in the ways that I think it pretty obviously needed to be reinforced. So I agree with a lot of what Bradley Carnell said. He's mixed and matched and tried to create different ways to generate chances. They're facing, like, Roman Berkey has been good this year. He was otherworldly last year. He's been good this year. He's facing about 30% fewer shots per game. That tells me structurally that this team has improved. But just the luck isn't there. And so now you can't count on luck year after year after year. You have to add quality. And they're out there now making signings, trying to add quality, which was, I'm not going to say it was a transfer window too late because this team still very much has the chance to make the playoffs. Though it's a transfer window too late in terms of trying to defend their perch at the top of the Western Conference. Like, that is very obviously not going to happen. And it's been regression in all the ways that we said last year that it was going to be regression. And in all the ways that I'm sure you were thinking when you picked them, I think, 12th in the West in our preseason predictions? Like, what was what was your thought process on that?
My thought process was that teams had figured out the style of play and had figured out how to stop giving away easy chances, basically, to this team. And they'd figured that out during the 2023 season. It hadn't been like, at the end of the year, Sporting Kansas City were the ones, and they did it. It was pretty much everyone had figured that out. I just thought that losing Nico Gioacchini was a much bigger loss than anybody else seemed to be making out, just in terms of, one, creating opportunities via the press, because we know they want to do that, but also in terms of stretching the field and being truly a finisher. I like Sam Adeniran, but he was one of the guys last year that was just overperforming at such a high level. And Aziel Jackson, too. I just thought, man, it's a lot to ask those two guys to take on this huge, this huge load. And the load being huge was to maintain the level from last year in terms of performance, not to just be a playoff team, but to maintain. So I just didn't think that was ever really going to be a possibility. And I just didn't see the form turning around. It is good news now that we're, first Cedric Teuhert is signed, and that should help. He's got a good goal scoring record in the two Bundesliga, and Bradley Carnell talked about it. I mean, a little bit of better decision-making from him in the final third, a little bit more dynamism and just, again, quality. And then Marcel Hartl is a guy that I will be frank. I know almost nothing about other than watching highlight videos and seeing the stats. And the stats are very good for St. Pauli. He helped them get promoted. 21 goals, 15 assists in 37 games, all comps in the season that just ended. I believe he's going to be on a free should he come. He's 28 years old, in the prime of his career, has been super effective at that level. And it's probably going to translate. I hope they get it done. I really hope they get it done.
He has the profile of a guy who will be very, very good, or maybe even better than very good in MLS, and the profile of a guy that they could have used to start the season. Just to put numbers to it, to give you an idea of what you, the listener, of what Weeby and I are talking about, starting with the group stage of the Leagues Cup last year. So from July 23rd onwards, St. Louis were 4 wins, 8 losses, 3 draws across all competitions. the writing was on the wall. You didn't have to look far to see a half season of struggle like this, like where they are now. You didn't have to look far to see that it was coming. And now it's here, and hopefully the moves that the front office is making will give Bradley Carnell, you know, he's been having to fight with one hand behind his back. So hopefully the moves the front office is making will give him the firepower he needs to get this team back into the hunt.
Absolutely. And by the way, it's probably not a bad idea, MLS teams, to go see who the Columbus Crew have discovery claims on and then just try to draft in their wake. Like that might not be the worst strategy that you could have. I will give credit to Bradley. I mean, I went back and watched a good amount of film after I chatted with him just to try to get a better feel. And I do think that this team, despite being still at the bottom of the league in possession, has more ideas about how they want to try to build
100%.
Goal scoring opportunities. I just don't think that, you know, it was a lot to ask Joe Klaus to be as special as he was last year, again this year, with more tape on him and less talent around him. It was a lot to ask a team when they lose Ed Lewin to be able to keep up the sort of quality and build up, because he is their best player. They lose Ostrek. They have injuries all over the field, et cetera, et cetera. It was a lot to ask that they would keep that level as high as it was. And now they're trying to figure it out a little bit. So we'll see if that happens. Last year, St. Louis, obviously sort of in and around that Shield race-ish. This year, Doyle, I've said it on this show. I've said it on Countdown and Wrap Up, and I'm all over it. I'm juiced. I think this has the potential to be the best Supporters Shield race season of all time. 2022 was fun with, you know, Philly and LAFC. It didn't quite have the drama of 2018 between Atlanta and the Red Bulls, but I'm counting five teams, maybe even seven teams that could be right there. Miami are in first right now. What an incredible win they got in Philly. Cincinnati,
Cincinnati are in first in terms of points per game.
2.12, good point. And they've got two games in hand on Miami and just 2 points back. And, you know, look, they were looking like they might take an L in San Jose. And that's one of those losses where you're like, oh, well, you might not win the Shield if you're doing that. And then Lucho was like, no, I'm going to jump on the gas pedal with 2 feet. RSL, disappointing weekend, a scoreless draw in Montreal, but they're still right there with 18 games played and 34 points. LAFC, 6 straight wins. They've got 17 games played, so two in hand on Miami, and they're at 33. And then Columbus, 4 straight away wins, and they play Miami midweek, and they got 1.8 points per game. Is this the best Shield race ever? Will it be? And who would you be backing?
So 2018 is still the best Shield race ever, because they were the Red Bulls and Atlanta were clearly the two best teams in the league, and they were both clearly going for it. The Red Bull, it was in their DNA. Right, the Shield means a lot to them. It always has. They went for it. Atlanta, I remember Tata playing Miguel Almiron through injuries down the stretch and risking him for the playoffs to try to win the Shield. So it was the two best teams in the league with, you know, the fans hated each other, the players hated each other, contrasting styles of play. That, to me, is still the gold standard. 2022 was real close, but that felt more like LAFC sort of backing into it. They weren't as sharp down the stretch as Philly, and it was more a question of, will Philly catch them? And of course, 2014 was kind of a great Shield race until Bruce Arena decided he didn't care about it on the last day of the season and kind of rotated the squad a little bit.
That's classic Bruce right there.
Oh, it's so classic. Yeah, it's Bruce being Bruce, man. But 2018 is still the standard. Of these five teams that you mentioned, I think that Miami's advantage is that they will have Messi for the stretch run, and it's stupid to bet against Messi. Cincinnati's advantage is that they've invested more in defense than anybody in the league, and hopefully that continues to be hopefully we get to see their first team defense for most of the rest of the season. That isn't questioned now with Matt Miazga taking an injury this past week. The Crew are the Crew. I think we probably, if we took a straw poll right now, most people would agree they're the best team in the league. And now they're on 4 straight wins on the road and making up ground despite having made it all the way to CONCACAF Champions Cup final. By the underlying numbers, LAFC have been the best team in the league by a mile. By a mile, almost doubling up the second best expected goal differential.
You think Olivier Giroud might help a little bit too?
You would assume. I mean, Mateus Bogus has been good, but I think would probably prefer Olivier Giroud. And then of the group, RSL are kind of a dark horse. I think we saw this past weekend the one piece away nature of RSL, where it was like that game felt like it was going to be Cucho or Chicho or nothing, right? And so they need that number 10. And I know Matt Crooks missed this game, and Matt Crooks has been pretty good, but like they need that one other guy who could go out and win a match when it seems like their luck is against them. That's the five, maybe even four, depending on how you feel about RSL. NYCFC, as I said, are in that next tier down, and you kind of shuffle around from there.
I even think you could look, if I was going to get a little bit ballsy, I might even throw the Red Bulls in there.
And nope.
only because they have the points right now, and they have done it without Forsberg being available all the time. And again, if Tommy Scoops is right, if they go get a number nine, that's the stretch run. Like,
did you watch Yusuf Paulsen come on for Denmark the other day?
I didn't.
I mean, that kind of makes sense, right?
He's your boy. Yeah.
He's 30. So he's still
talk time. To your boy.
Right?
How about you, dude?
And he's like, he's no longer first choice in Leipzig. And granted, he's never been a clinical goal scorer, but I think he would be awesome in MLS. And yeah, Emil, holler at your guy.
I like that. I like that. But that's not the only team that is going to make moves in the summer. And I have a little bit of a beef with the MLS transfer window just because it opens July 19th.
Yeah.
And so to me, what I wish is that window opened the same time as the European window. Because to me, you're hamstringing your clubs and their ability to impact their teams in the summer in a timely manner as it relates to when they will lose players. You know, I think of Yakumakis right now. I think of Carranza. Like, if we want our teams, our clubs, the projects being built, the competition to be at its very best, I think there needs to be some attention paid to that summer transfer window, when it opens and how long it is open, to allow our clubs to be the most competitive they can be for the longest period of time. That's neither here nor there, but there will be some changes here. Like, come on, Miami, they'll find a way to make an impactful change. Cincinnati are talking about making a huge signing if they can move on from Aaron Bupinza, which it certainly seems like they're going to. You know, Taylor Twellman on Countdown the other day was saying it. Pat Noonan has said, watch out, we're planning something big. RSL can open a DP spot if they buy down Matt Crooks. By the way, congratulations to Matt Crooks. I believe he was gone to get married, I think. So congratulations to him. Giroud is coming for LAFC. Obviously, the Crew are making moves. New York City could. Red Bulls seem like they will. Like, that is a freaking potent mix, and it's absolutely scintillating if it all can stick together. Now, the flip side of that, Doyle, is I don't think we'll see a points record set this year, but all these elite teams mean that the mediocrity sort of in the mid to bottom is very strong. The mid-offs are extremely competitive. I was looking at the Eastern Conference because I have this doc, the race to the playoffs safe mark, and I set the safe mark at 45 points. That's generally around ninth place in both conferences, like sort of like, hey, guesstimate. And in the Eastern Conference right now, from Philly in eighth all the way to New England in 15th, every single one of those teams would basically have to improve their point per game to get to 45 by like 0.3 to 0.6. That is a huge leap. I think there's a possibility in the Eastern Conference in particular that we could see a team make the playoffs, maybe even like 39 points. That's possible. That's mid.
Man, it's that's possible. Epically,
that's it, below it, mid.
It doesn't seem likely. It doesn't. I have to believe that some of these teams in, you know, eighth, ninth, tenth place are going to figure it out. But looking at it, oh, that is grim. But you know, if you want to start using or keep using more Zoomer slang, Weeby, I'm not going to step on you anymore. Please tell me more about how mid it is. No cap.
I think I saw a Twitter video. I saw a Twitter video and somebody was using mid, and I'm going to walk away slowly from this. On God, this is embarrassing. All right, man of the match day. Let's talk about LAFC. Denny Bawanga is a nightmare. Orlando played really quite well at home, like a performance that they normally would look around and say, I think we should have 3 points. And it wasn't that close because Bawanga just stepped on him late on. He's got 12 goals, 6 assists. It's his fourth multi-goal game of the season. The goal where he just runs through the entire back line and then rounds Mason Sadahara, that one is like, you know, it's prime Chris Berman. Whoop, 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 whoop. Just rumbling and, you know, stumbling his way through the entire back line. And now Matej Bogus is just going to score goals in the open field from the wing too. And what do you do against LAFC at this point?
No, it was brilliant. And I've praised Steve Cherundolo a lot over the past couple of months for remembering that he has a ton of skilled players on his team and that they should use the ball. And they have done that. And they have played better because of that. A lot of this this streak, this run that they're on, has come from being something closer to the 2022 version of LAFC than the 2023 version that, you know, by the time the playoffs came around last year, they were getting 25-30% of the ball. Well, became 2-1 note.
But it was 37% in this game. Because yeah, why would you not give Orlando the ball at home?
Exactly. That said, is how I was going to follow it up. If you say we're going to come upfield and we're going to give Dennis Bouanga the chance to run into open space and attack an isolated fullback or round a goalkeeper at speed or play in Matej Bogus against guys who he's going to have a speed advantage against, that club is still in the bag for LAFC. It's maybe even their preferred club. And Orlando played well, but they gave LAFC 4 or 5 chances to get out into the open field, and it turned into 3 goals. And LAFC can still do that to you, and Orlando are still left looking for solutions to a season that's kind of spinning away from them pretty rapidly at this point.
They've got 1 win in 9 home games, do Orlando City.
Poof.
That's whack. I don't even think we put that's whack in the rundown today because it was so busy. That's my whack. That's my whackest thing.
That's
a
mid.
Team that extreme. That's below mid. Whatever it is that's below mid, that's what this is. And for a team that was second in the East last year, it's nowhere near good enough.
What did you think of the 4-2 diamond? It was more of almost like the old Y midfield that the Galaxy played 10 years ago, where it was the number 10 was in front of the number 6, but the shuttlers, the wide midfielders, were actually higher than the number 10, and then there are two true forwards in Luis Muriel and Duncan McGuire. I actually thought it worked pretty well for Orlando. The issue is
they're not finishing. They didn't finish at all.
Yeah, they didn't finish at all, and then the nature of playing that kind of midfield is you do leave yourself exposed to second balls and runouts. But I was actually kind of encouraged by the performance from Orlando, not necessarily the scoreline.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was Duncan McGuire's best game. Luis Muriel still just doesn't seem to be able to find moments goal dangerous, but that pass is stupid.
Yeah.
Like, it looked like that ball was frozen in midair as it was hovering above to Martin Ojeda. I just go back to with this team, if finishing in this game in particular is the issue, but overall I think their biggest issue outside of, some of the issues giving up goals is they don't create, and that comes down to their best players, their DPs, not being productive or creative enough and not having enough solutions to the problems that they're facing. Like, Facundo Torres hasn't been anywhere near his level last year. They've never figured out how to use Martin Ojeda. Angulo is not that guy. He's more the guy that benefits from that aspect of play. And Muriel has had moments, but nothing sustained. It just, there's too many big-time players who are not playing at a big-time level. And, you know, I felt bad for Facundo Torres in this game because he hasn't missed a penalty in, like, his entire career, I don't think. I mean, I think from, like, Peñarol to Orlando, I think he's perfect. And you just felt in that moment against Lloris when he takes it, and he's just like, I've just got to hit this as hard as I possibly can. That he just that's a lack of confidence to me in the way that he took that. And I thought he like was going to kill somebody in the concourse. That thing was zooming straight up into like the beer line. Felt terrible for him on that front. All right, let's keep it moving. Our alternative man of the match day is, no, it's not Yuya Kubo who won the official award. Shame on you voters. I don't want to be a shame guy, but yes, Yuya Kubo scored 3 goals in 9 minutes. Yes, but he is he's the Lassiter to Lucho's Pibe. Lucho just is like, hey, I need someone to score these goals. Yuya, you're going to be that man on this day. Cincinnati down to San Jose and just come back and get a 4-2 win on the road because they have by far the best player on the field who just understands Doyle, when to turn it on. And it's been, that's how they won the Shield last year.
Yeah.
Is it Lucho is just like, I know how to, we're going to win this game. I'm going to show you how.
Yeah. He has a level that very few players in this league could match. And what was beautiful about it, and this is a time capsule Lucho Acosta performance, because the first assist is like a center forward assist where he's checking back to the ball and he just knows the sort of geometry of the field and the layout of the opposing defense. And he just plays a sort of a blind one-time ball into the run of Yu Yakubo. I saw Brian McBride.
The shape of that ball, Doyle.
Brian McBride played that ball a million times. It's what made Brian McBride so great, was understanding the shape of the field. And here's Lucho Acosta, who's 5'3" and a number 10, and he's playing that perfect center forward ball. So that was one. Two is like, there are two players in MLS who provide this assist. It's Lucho or it's Messi, and he just dribbles into the box and beats what, like two or three guys off the dribble, and then has the footwork and the skill to take touches in sort of these half spaces in time where other people can't operate, and puts it on Yuya's foot. And then the third one was like relatively like pedestrian compared to those two, but it's also like he has the strength and the footwork to sort of fend off a challenge and then slip a perfect ball, perfectly weighted, into Yu Yakubo's run. The Quakes weren't bad, man. The Quakes had their chances. They scored a couple of goals. I thought they put Cincy under real pressure, and 15 minutes to go, Lou just said, no, I'm going to win this game for my team. He's now up to 13 assists, and we're halfway through the season. Oh. only four players in MLS history have had 20 or more assists in a season. Our good friend Sasha Kljestan had 20 in 2016. Max Morales had 20 in 2019. The all-time record is Carlos Valderrama, who had 26 back in 2000.
In a different era.
Yes, a different era where you were
like, second assists, any kind of time of pass before the original assist is an assist.
Correct. Whereas we're more selective about giving second assists now. I would be surprised if he doesn't end up over 20 assists this season. He might even hit Pibe, catch Pibe for you know, first all time. I think he'll come close at least. He's on 91 assists for his career, which is tied for ninth all time. So he's entered the top 10. He could end up being the eighth guy ever to go over 100 assists in his MLS career. And
he could do that this year.
I would be kind of surprised if he didn't at this point. And then long-term, Landon's record is 136 assists. And Lucho just turned 30 2 weeks ago. I didn't think anybody would
be much in reach. Very much.
I didn't think anybody would ever break that record, but like, we could be talking about that 2 years from now. We could be like, oh, the countdown's on, he's five away. Like, that's the type of player Lucho Acosta is. He won MVP last year. He won the Shield last year. He clearly is not done. And this Cincinnati team, honestly, might be better than last year's Cincinnati team, and that team was really, really good.
And here's the thing. Think about last year's team. Think about the players who surrounded him. Think about the guys that he was providing assists to on a regular basis. Now think about this FC Cincinnati team. So far, Aaron Bupinza has barely played. He's supposed to be that like difference-making, top-tier number nine. You no longer have, obviously, Vasquez. So, okay, that's gone. That target is gone for you. If you look at goal scoring, Yu Yakubo has 7. Orochano has 3. Kevin Kelsey has 3. Bupinza has 2. Sergio Santos has 2. Boucha, Robinson. I mean, he's working with material here in terms of creating assists that you would not expect him to be on this number. And then if you're talking about the rest of the season, it's only going to get better. Kelsey just got there. He's just integrating. Yeah. If they go get a big-time number nine, okay, well, that changes everything as well. Like, it's open play, it's set pieces, it's every phase of the game, basically, for Lucho. And he is working himself into, if he's not already there, one of the all-time great number 10s in this league. Like, the legacy that he's leaving is, it's right there.
I think he's already there. And I think the only thing missing for him, well, two things, MLS Cup and a long CONCACAF Champions Cup run. I think those are the two things that he needs to add to his resume. And then we're talking about him kind of in the same breath as guys like Echeverry and Cienfuegos and Valeri and Ladero. Like, that's the type of company this man is keeping.
Boy, bad news for Matt Miazga. We feel for Matt. He was making a defensive play, sliding, and it's one of those ugly challenges. His leg hit the woodwork. And while I'm thinking about this right now, I'm remiss because I had a note in here and I missed it. Our thoughts go out to Celio Pompeu, who suffered just an absolutely devastating injury in that St. Louis-Dallas match, a dislocated ankle and then a broken fibula. And it was one that I don't recommend you go watch the replay on. You see something like that and you just hope for the very best for him. I know he had surgery this morning, so our thoughts go to Pompeu as well as Matt Miazga. Word is that it's not a break for Miazga, but a laceration. And Pat Noonan earlier today said that Miazga will not be available for Wednesday's game against Philly. Quote, it's not great. Full medical report is coming in, and they say it could be long-term for Matt Miazga. So that affects what we're talking about in the supporter shield and a league's best defense. Miles Robinson being gone on international duty also affects that. What's your level of concern for Cincinnati given this little bit of news for Miazga and what could be both a Copa America and an Olympics absence for Miles Robinson?
I'll be surprised if Miles Robinson goes to both. I know that Cincinnati's done a really great job of playing nice with U.S. soccer, but two separate tournaments in one summer just doesn't happen. Maybe if Miazga was 100% healthy, they'd have let it go. But it would be... It would be a little surprising, though. Now it occurs to me, maybe part of the reason Miles Robinson signed with Cincinnati as a free agent is because he wanted to play both.
Yeah, maybe.
And this could have been part of the free agent. But with Miazga hurt, if he's out for a while, it's tough to imagine them letting Miles Robinson go to both. That said, they've done a really good job of creating depth along that back line. They did a nice job with Ian Murphy picking him last year and developing over the past year and a half. Nick Haglund, everybody in the world laughed at the price they paid for Nick Haglund 5 years ago. But under Pat Noonan,
that's a small definition of world, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Under Pat Noonan,
the whole world.
Under Pat Noonan, he's become like a really reliable starting caliber fullback or center back. And then there's Kip Keller, who they got off the scrap heap from Austin. So, and he's given them good minutes, and then they've shown the ability to flex other guys into there as well. So I'm not like, it doesn't feel like a sky is falling moment, especially because it's not a leg break. If Miazga's leg was broken and he was going to miss the next 6 months, then you're talking about reassessing the whole thing. But the fact that it's not that gives me hope that, you know, hopefully we could see him back a month from now. And if that's the case, then Cincinnati's going to be just fine, even if they do miss Miles Robinson for both tournaments this summer.
Boy, we must have missed each other, Doyle, because we're 50 minutes in already, and we have a lot more to talk about. So
we'll do a three-hour show. Andres has said he's fine with a three-hour show.
Yeah, we'll try to pick up the pace just a little bit. Philadelphia-Miami, this was an absolute brain blend, certainly for the Union, and big joy for Miami, who go on the road after a tough run at home before the international break and get 3 points. Leo Alfonso, Yannick Bright, you don't have Messi, you don't have Suarez. Well, you got two super draft picks, and they got the winner late in this match. Bright to Alfonso, who got in behind and put poor Jakub Glesnes in a straight-up blender. great goal on this one, and it was interesting, too, because Alfonso was actually in the Union Academy, and then he was in Miami's Academy, and then he was a UVA Cavalier, and then he was drafted. And he's now in Miami, where he's not getting playing time because they're loaded, but he's still finding a way to make an impact. It's his second goal of the season. And Miami just march on with two red cards, by the way, down one man, because Leon Flott got a red card when all this happened. Let's skip the Miami part because we talk about them all the time. And let's talk Philly, Doyle, because this is yet another huge gut punch for this Union team. They've now lost five games at home, and I was sort of dragging the Orlando side for being terrible on their home field. And it's basically the same record for the Union. And that is shocking because over the last 2 years, they lost one time at home in the regular season. What do you make of this current spiral that the Union are in? Where should the pressure fall? Are we seeing the window for this group just being slammed shut and then locked? What is happening?
Well, to the last part of that, it feels like it. It feels like the window has shut on this group. And that's two reasons. One is that they're no longer dominating in their own box. And if you look at all the wonderful things the Union did in attack, basically from 2016 through, you know, the end of last year, it was fun. But what really separated this team over that time span was dominating in their own area defensively, not giving up cheap goals, not making it possible for most teams to even build quality chances against them. And I think they're still pretty good at preventing quality chances en masse, but they're just prone to individual breakdowns and errors in center from the center backs, from the goalkeepers, and at defensive midfield that were not a part of their DNA at any point in the past 5 years. So that's one. And two is like all the criticisms that we levied at the St. Louis front office for not adequately reinforcing the roster. We have to levy it at Ernst Tanner and the front office in Philadelphia. And in fact, Kai Wagner levied those criticisms.
Andre Blake has as well.
As Alejandro Bedoya. Now, I'll put my hand up. I made the argument heading into the season that this particular group deserved one more run at it. Resign everybody, bring everybody back, count on improvement from within and the pride of the veterans, the veteran holdovers to elevate this team to contender status. I was dead wrong about that. I was dead wrong. Like Jack McGlynn has been a little bit better. Quinn Sullivan has been a lot better, but that's not enough to elevate this team when you add in the veterans collectively regressing. So I was wrong. But the players who are asking for more help and are still asking for more help, they were very clearly correct. And the good news is more help will probably be on the way because it seems like they're about to sell Julian Carranza, who, oh, by the way, has been their best player. Seems like they're about to sell him to Feyenoord Rotterdam.
Do you think more help is on the way? I mean, this is a last 6 months of the deal for Carranza. So how much is Feyenoord really going to be paying in this sense? And Jim Curtin has said repeatedly, this is the group that we have to work with. And I go back to what I said about the window. It opens and most teams will have maybe 10 games to get it figured out. So I'm not sure that help is on the way, and certainly not help at the level that this group needs to not just be a playoff team, but to be a team that has real championship hopes. And that's what hurts. Well, that's what hurts because they were so close so many times, spending and investing so much less than basically everyone else in the league. I mean, I'm looking at Twitter and I'm you know, kind of taking the temperature of Union fans after all this, and I get that they're hurting and that this is awful and they're used to this level of success and capability and sort of punching teams in the mouth and being the aggressor and being the team that wins games like that. And they're frustrated. And I see a lot of finger pointing at Jim Curtin and I just feel like I'm taking crazy pills, man. It's insane. Like how spoiled can you be? How spoiled can you be for all the success that the Union have had, all the almost moments? And I get that you're frustrated. You wanted to get one of those trophies. You think Jim Curtin, a Philly guy through and through, a Union guy through and through, wanted to get one of those more than you did? Yeah, he did. Hell, he wanted to keep his captain in the offseason, and the front office was pushing him out. And then look at the last three windows. There's no impact player straight up that came in. Like, can you name one? Who would it be? These are three windows since you were on the brink of MLS Cup and on the brink of winning the Supporters Shield.
Yeah.
There just has to be, if they want to be a contender in this day and age of Major League Soccer, there are so many amazing things that the Philadelphia Union have built and have done and will give them the foundation to be that in terms of talent development, in terms of talent identification, the way the academy is run and produces players. The head coach is among the best in Major League Soccer, in my opinion. But the final piece is investment. It's investment. Because you just lost your best player in Julian Carranza for close to free. It's very unlikely, as things are constructed now and sort of writing on the wall, that a player of his quality will come in to replace him. And so now you're saying, well, look, God love him. I think Gosdog's been a great player in this league, still is. Not an elite number 10, I don't think, in the current crop. Certainly not in the group that we're talking about on the teams that want to go win the Shield and, you know, go win MLS Cup. Mikel Ua's been fine, but mostly a disappointment. And that's not his fault. He was signed for like $3 million. He's been probably exactly what you would expect him to be. But like at some point, if you want to be a team that does what you haven't done, and that's win a championship and a changing MLS, you've got to go recruit at a different level. And not only will that make you a different team in terms of what your aspirations can be, it will also make the players that you develop and push through your academy in a much better position to thrive and impact your team at a high level and not have any pressure on them to be the solution, just to augment what the group does. And that will make you more money in the transfer market as well.
To that point, we have sung the praises of Wilfred Nancy on this show for 4 years. And we've sung loudly about how great the crew were last year and how great they are this year and how they do such a wonderful job of pushing young players into big roles and developing them. The best player on their team is Cucho Hernandez, and they spent $10 million to get him. Then last summer, this time, they went out and they spent $7, $8 million to get Diego Rossi. That's the type of investment we're talking about for Philadelphia. I don't think it's possible to compete at the top of MLS without those kinds of players.
I mean, look at LAFC. And again, I understand it's a different market. It's different. Everything is different. And I'm not saying it's the same. I'm just saying, look at how they responded to winning that MLS Cup and so much of that team leaving. You know, Denny Belonga was an add to that team. Look what he is now. And he was a $6, $7 million signing. Olivier Giroud going back and getting Atuesta. You know, even on the young player front, the Bogushes of the world and, you know, all these young players that have been brought in. And then, you know, as we talked about on a recent show, they took the L a couple times when they needed to take the L. I don't expect Philadelphia Union to be at the top of MLS in spending. But if the Philadelphia Union could be in the middle of the pack, I think that would change things drastically, because, like I said, they have this foundation that should allow them to build depth and then quality as those young players come through from their academy. And to be a place where those type of players want to come, and to be a place where the Julian Carranzas of the world want to come, and the Kai Wagners and the, you know, the Glesneses and all these guys who have elevated this project, the Jose Martinez's, who didn't have the reputation before they came in, but had the ability and then were elevated within this club. There's all these really valuable things that the Union have. And I just want to see them sort of go for it in a way that would reflect their desire to win silverware. And it's sad to me to see them in this moment. And I'm sad for Jim. I'm sad for these players. I'm sad for the organization overall. I'm sad for the fans. Like, I know this is painful. But in many ways, they should just thank their lucky stars that they've been this model of consistency while batting above their sort of expectation level for so long. Anyway. All right. New England, Vancouver. Three straight wins for the Revs, Doyle. Is this for real? For real, for real?
I don't think it's for real, but they're definitely better than they were to start the season. I think part of it is they've been cleaner playing out of the back, building out of the back, so Carlos Hill isn't having to drop quite as deep. And he's more connected to the front line. The front line is more dangerous now that Dylan Barrero is back, and Esmer Barakterevich has sort of developed into a really dangerous winger. And so when you have pieces sliding into place like that, it's been improved. I still don't think they're a great defensive team. I still am not expecting them to make the playoffs. And if you look at their underlying numbers the past three games, it still hasn't been great, but they're better than they were. That's a start.
It is a start.
What do you feel about the Revs? Do you like their aura? He's looking for Gen Z slang in the...
You weren't supposed to give that away.
In the chat.
I think it was sus that No Buck did not get a ton of playing time to start the season. And congratulations to the young man for scoring a banger. I do think there are some things that can be done in the summer. I'm not sure that Vrioni is the answer for them up top. I mean, it just sort of feels like there's one goal he scores, and he scored it in this game that will, on his left foot, through ball in behind, first time finish. And they would benefit from a little bit more variety there. And I still don't think the midfield is set up personnel-wise in a way that Caleb Porter prefers. So there's a lot of work for this team to do. But for the time being, three straight wins and being 4 points out of the playoffs after your star player christened you the worst team in the league, that's a good sign. How about Charlotte? It might not always be beautiful, Doyle, but they just keep finding a way up to fifth in the East. 18 goals allowed this season. I think it was their eighth shutout against DC United. They really won the second ball game, which you have to do against Christian Benteke, and controlled him in the box. Credit to Milanda and Privet for that. Here's a little nugget for you. Dean Smith is giving a crate of wine to his team, players, different people on the team every time they get a shutout. He says that he feels he's probably close to earning free bottles and that this is costing him significantly, but I think it's a cost he's happy to pay at this point. But let's talk DPs. Because I was listening to an interview, a really nice interview out of Charlotte on their sports radio station by my guy Will. I'm so sorry. Willie P. Style on Twitter, and I'm going to mispronounce his last name, so I'm not even going to try. Will P-A-L-A-S-Z-C-Z-U-K.
Polashek. You didn't really grow up in a Polish town.
I didn't. Well done. I should have just fed you for that one. But a great interview with Zoran Kroneta, who said it's very possible that Karol Swiderski could come back, that he could be back in this team. If Swiderski comes back, how would he fit in? And what should they do with potentially another DP spot? Because they could buy down Diagre to open that one up.
Yeah, I mean, he would actually fit in really well, because you get the sense from everything that Dean Smith has said and the way they've played that they kind of want more of the goal scoring to come from the wingers. Not all of it. Like, you still need number nine to be goal dangerous, and Patrick Osimhen kind of has, but Spoderski, his strength is that he's a 9.5. He could be goal dangerous, but he's also a playmaker. He's really good at putting those wingers into spots where they can be match winners. So I actually think he makes a lot of sense, especially when you consider the fact that I'm not sure this team's going to go out and get a number 10. I actually think if they get a playmaker, a chance creator, it might be a winger to play opposite Leal Labada, instead of a pure midfielder. I do expect them to buy Brecht De Jager down. And if the new rules come in, they could do that and still have multiple U22 slot usage, which is important for the roster build. But Swiderski is actually, look, man, he's the kind of guy I would be looking for to fit that role. And if think about it for the Union. If they sell Julian Carranza, and they need a DP number 9, isn't Swiderski kind of perfect for, like, his best moments for Poland have come while playing as a second striker in a 4-4-2 or a 3-5-2. Now, granted, the first striker, the number 9 in that Polish team, is Robert Lewandowski, and he's a little bit better than Mikhail Urwa. But, like, he's a really good player. And it didn't work under Christian Latanzio for a lot of reasons, but, like, he's the type of guy that a lot of MLS teams should be after if he's not going to fit what Charlotte want to do under Dean Smith.
I think, as much as it pains me to say this, I think Charlotte could really benefit from a senior striker, DP number 9, to take pressure off of Patrick Osimhen. And that's not because I have any less faith in Osimhen, just as part of his development process. Maybe too much has been thrust on him maybe too soon, but to reach their potential, they just need a more efficient finisher. And it's just, it hasn't been there for Ajimon yet. He's such a problem. He really is an impossible matchup, but it's that moment that they need. So look, if it's Swiderski, if Swiderski goes to another European team, whatever, and they sign a guy there, that's fine. I do think they also need creativity in the midfield. So for me in the summer, to consider it like an A window for them, it would be a goal scorer at a reliable level, and then some sort of U22 or DP in that 10 spot. And we'll see if they can do it. Charlotte, for credit to them, have been ambitious. They've been willing to say we made a mistake and go back to the drawing board, and Abada looks like a great signing so far. Well done as well to Vargas for getting a goal in this game. Really nice header from him. Okay, let's keep it going. Let's talk transfers. Atlanta 2, Houston 2. Rob Valentino gets a draw. He's got a winning record as an interim manager. That's pretty crazy, but also sick. Giakoumakis is officially off to Cruz Azul for $10 million. That's a good piece of business, I think, overall. $6 million come up on a 29-year-old that was frequently injured, but also quality, best 11 quality, 24 goals in 43 games quality. But this is a big, big summer for Atlanta. It's a coach. It's a number nine. It's Thiago Almada. It's a lot of things.
We're not sure it's Thiago Almada. Let's start there, right? Because okay. I've heard from numerous people around the league that Atlanta want to keep Thiago Almada and might end up making him the kind of offer in terms of salary that makes him a centerpiece of this club for the next 10 years.
Like we're talking like Jerdan Shaqiri number here?
I believe so, yeah. I would love that if I was an Atlanta fan, because even this year, Almada's been really good. The guys around him have not finished the chances that he's created. He's still 95th percentile in all the chance creation metrics. He still wants to get on the ball. He's working for the team. Now, granted, he's also talking to Boca Juniors. He was just talking about the fact that Juan Roman Riquelme called him the other day. So there is stuff that could happen either way, but I don't think it's a given that Almada's gone. It is obviously official that Giakoumakis is gone, and I agree with you across the board. He's a great goal scorer. He's a very good player. He's a frequently injured 29-year-old Cruz Azul paid $10 million for 18 months after Atlanta paid $4.2 million. Go ahead.
Can I ask you something? When I saw that number, I thought to myself, can Atlanta United and the rest of MLS in part thank Cincinnati and Brandon Vasquez for that number?
I mean,
do you think that Brandon Vasquez helped sort of prove the point and establish a market at a level that allows an Atlanta United to say, no, you got to pay 10?
It probably plays into it. Yeah, it probably does. And, it was really good work by Cincinnati to get what they got for Brandon Vasquez. This is even better work by Atlanta to get this. Go ahead, Weeby.
We have some inside information from Maria in the group chat here, producer Maria. Quote, Cruz Azul is known to overpay out of desperation. So that's good. I enjoy that. Also, it makes League's Cup much more spicy. What should Atlanta do in the summer with that open DP spot?
Well, I think they're going to go big on a number nine. And for Atlanta, go big has tended to mean $15, $18 million. I don't know who that means. We know that Garth Lagerwey has a profile that he's looked for, guys who are in their primes, as Giakoumakis was, and who have proven it in multiple countries. So it's a pretty wide net they'll be able to cast. Watching the Euros today, I know Romelu Lukaku did not cover himself in glory this morning, but he would look good in MLS at this point. He's a little bit older, but he's 31, is still really, really good. And Romelu Lukaku is a star on the world stage. And
oh my God, get Christian Benteke on the freaking phone.
Right?
Romelu, it's awesome here, man. And let me tell you, Atlanta's going to be even better.
Yeah, look, Atlanta's the black capital of America. And this team has had a lot of great players, a lot of great black players. They have not had a black player who is a world star. And that's what Romelu Lukaku is. I'm not, I haven't heard a single word that this could happen. And presumably with a player of this profile,
speak it into reality right now.
You're talking about someone like you would be bidding against, you know, Fenerbahce and Galatasaray and Saudi Arabia and Dubai. Like that's who you're going against. But Arthur Blank could do that. And I think just culturally, it would be a touchstone moment for a club that has already produced a lot of those in less than a decade. I would love to see that. I don't know if that's what going big means for a number nine for Atlanta United, but it's certainly something that would catch the attention of every single club in the Americas.
Well, you got me excited. You got me excited.
Hey, hey, two weeks ago, I was saying they should hire Jurgen Klopp as their manager too. So, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
I got ideas.
Sign me up right now. We have to talk about Houston here. Also on the DP front, big time signing, club record signing, Ezequiel Ponce, the number nine, now in Houston. Look, they did a big deep dive. They did a world search. I know Houston are into using data to try to narrow down their targets. We're looking for a guy that was a goal scorer for sure, but also a guy in his prime who had defensive work rate. And Ponce has been playing for Matias Almeida at AEK recently. So if you think that dude's not running his tail off, you're out of your mind. So he's combining two things that this club needed. Congratulations to the entire front office for getting the deal done. Well done to ownership and Ted Siegel for putting the funds behind it and making it happen and setting a new transfer record. We just keep saying that every single window for so many teams around MLS. He is not a guy, I would say, Doyle, that when you look at his resume, he scored a good amount of goals, but not at top five European league level. Those have been the moments in his career where he hasn't quite had that level of productivity, but in Greece and Russia, scored a boatload of goals there. They think he is the missing piece here to provide balance to the squad. Remember, this is a team that's still in the playoff places while playing like Kowalczyk as a false nine and getting goals from Latif Blessing and just trying to like find a way and stitch it all together. And hey, Ibrahim Aliou, can you provide some goals? Who can step up in this moment? And now they have the guy that they think is their goal scorer. And according to everybody I talked to, he was gung-ho on coming to Houston. He was like, this is the place I want to be with my family. This is where I'm going. And I understand it because he's bounced around a good amount in his career so far. What do you make of this signing? What sort of sign are Houston sending, not to the rest of the league, but to their fan base and to the rest of the players on this team?
Well, I mean, it's a record signing, so that lets you know the sign that they're sending to their fan base. We haven't seen the number yet, but I'm sure it'll come out. Ponce, everyone I've talked to over in Europe thinks that he'll be great in MLS, and particularly that he'll be great for this Dynamo team because he's like a rich man's version of Corey Baird. Corey Baird was really good last year playing kind of a 9.5. Sometimes he would occupy the center backs, but usually he would run into the gaps and sort of stretch the line both vertically and horizontally. And almost Tati Castellanos-ish. And like Tati, he also provides a ton of defensive effort as well. I don't think he's going to be that good, right? We're not talking about an MLS MVP here, but if he could be a 15-goal, 7-assist out there every week, defensive presence type of center forward, Houston will be really, really good. And I admire Houston a lot for being as good as they have been this year, despite being handicapped in terms of their roster selection and like they basically only have one way to do it, and that way has kept them in the hunt in the playoffs. And they have, I think, one of the two or three best defensive records in the league so far. I wouldn't have guessed that at this point this year. And Ponce, in particular, you know, you were talking before about wishing the window opened two or three weeks earlier. I mean, Ponce in particular, that's a guy and a team that it would just be manna from heaven if it could open next week, because Houston, they're kind of hanging on by a thread with Kowalczyk playing as that false number nine. And I expect it to be like flipping a switch when this guy arrives.
If you think back to last year with Houston, this is basically when they turned it on. Gets hot. Home field advantage ramps up. This is when they turned it on. So if they can hold on here a little bit, build some momentum, get Ponce in, that would be huge. If you're looking at that flaw that I mentioned about top five European leagues, I mean, just look at the top goal scorers in MLS, and I'll just list some guys who don't have that resume either. Arango didn't. Buonga really didn't either. Let's see. Gazdag, Jovalich, Hafa Navarro, Ryan Gauld, Lewis Morgan, Gomez, Felipe Mora. I mean, that is not a prerequisite to be a volume goal scorer and a super effective player in MLS. So good signing, it looks like, for the Houston Dynamo. Quick hits here and we'll get out of here. Montreal, Salt Lake, Drew, that happened. But Montreal got Kokoro and Opoku back, so keep an eye on that. They've got some personnel coming back in. They're hopeful about that. Nobody should be subjected to a New York Red Bulls Nashville game. I mean, it is just, it's brutal. Avert your eyes. There, we will talk more about...
I thought the Red Bulls played well. They just didn't finish.
Okay. BJ Callahan, reportedly a favorite to be the next head coach of Nashville. We will dig into that more on a future show. Congratulations to Cole Bassett, who's matched his all-time high in goals in Major League Soccer. Had an absolute banger against Austin. 2-0 win for the Rapids. They got back into the win column. Needed that one. And it looks like they're going to buy Hafa Navarro. So that's good news. Probably going to be a full DP, his performance, and now the competition for his signature has necessitated that. But clearly he's a fit with Chris Armas and this team. LA Galaxy didn't have Ricky Puig, but Sporting Kansas City were in town, and Gabriel Peck looked very, very good. So they waltzed to a 4-2 win. Kansas City is very much in the spoon race. Their ownership is saying it could be a three-window rebuild, and that Alan Pulido contract looks abjectly terrible right now. They have been linked to an Australian defensive midfielder in Norway, a 22-year-old Patrick Yazbek. So we'll see what happens in the summer for them. And then Seattle won against Minnesota home. Happy 50 years, I should say, to the Sounders organization. It's been an amazing half century for them. And the Loons are really in a world of hurt without Tani and now Teemu Pukki. So we'll see what happens for them. They created basically nothing in this match against the Sounders. We'll end here. What's one thing you're looking for on Wednesday, Doyle? Sell us on midweek MLS.
Columbus are on a five-match winning streak all on the road. They're at Inter-Miami at 7:30 on Wednesday. That game's on MLS Season Pass. It's free to watch on MLS Season Pass. These are two of the five teams that we think are legit Supporter Shield contenders. Miami are shorthanded without Messi, Suarez, Matias Rojas, all on international duty. David Ruiz and Toto Alvarez are suspended. I think Redondo and Gomez are still hurt. So Tata Martino is going to have to go down that roster to find answers in this one. It still feels like a big game to me. I would be surprised if this one doesn't feel like a playoff game from the whistle.
Big Shield implications. I don't want to be that guy, but it's four straight wins on the road. Could be five. Maybe you're counting the 3 points here. Right now, I'm certain that that Will Fernandez would like to get those 3 points as well. I'm going to go with Cincinnati and Philly. Obviously, you know, all stays in the family there with Chris Albright and Pat Noonan on one side and then Jim on the other. It is just a huge question mark as to how this Philadelphia team responds to what was just an absolute gut punch of a loss at home. In many ways, I think it's very good that they're going away and going to Cincinnati. So I'll be watching that one closely. And then I think maybe the best game of the night is Galaxy New York City. A little cross-conference action. Two teams that can really play, got some great attacking players, and the Galaxy tend to be in games where a lot of goals are scored. So I would be tuning into that one if I was you. Countdown's at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. MLS 360 starts at 7:30 when the games start. You can, of course, watch any game you want for free, as well as those studio shows. And then MLS wrap-up at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. We will, you guessed it, wrap up the entire night. It's been good to be back with you, Doyle. I'll see you next Monday. In the meantime, we'll try to book some interviews for Thursday. And see you all then. Enjoy your week, everybody. Enjoy the soccer. Adios.